John, it's a great pleasure to help kick off this session at a place as beautiful as this specific facility and as a place that no better symbolizes the opportunity to bring innovation to solve the challenges of the world than at Stanford University in the heart of Silicon Valley. One of the great things that Stanford has brought to this area and to the world is the opportunity to think creatively and cross-disciplinary about opportunities and to put real energy and resource behind those areas. CHP Peace Corps is one of those great examples. In just 10 years, the Institute has become a nationally and internationally recognized source of ideas and opportunities to see what's possible. Silicon Valley's location for the centers gives us a special opportunity to interact with the leaders in this region. This 10th anniversary celebration has been intentionally created to help bring together a unique cross-section of individuals and organizations playing a role in healthcare that symbolize that opportunity for new thinking. Alan, Kathy, and their colleagues at Stanford have made sure to reach out to a wide circle beyond Stanford to help develop a program that promises to intrigue us, stimulate new thinking, and launch conversations between those in the university and in university setting and those playing an active role in healthcare outside of the university. With that, it's my pleasure to introduce our moderator who will help guide us through this conversation over the course of the afternoon. Matt Miller is a senior fellow at the Center for American Progress, a contributing editor of Fortune, and the host of the fabulous public radio weekly show Left, Right, and Center. It was named by iTunes as one of its best podcasts of 2007. Matt's first book, The 2% Solution, Fixing America's Problems in Ways Liberals and Conservatives Can Love, was an LA Times bestseller. In its cover review, the Washington Post Sunday Book World called 2% a welcome return to political thinking on a big canvas agenda. The Wall Street Journal called it a small marvel of a book. Matt is at it again. In 2009, in January, his new book, published by Henry Holt, called The Tyranny of Dead Ideas, will be out. I encourage you all to pick it up as soon as it's out. In his business life, Matt is a senior advisor to McKinsey, where he advises on strategic communications and serves clients in healthcare, strategy, public policy, and the social sector. Matt served as a senior advisor to the director of the OMB from 1993 to 95 and was a White House fellow before that, serving as a special assistant to the chairman of the Federal Communications Commission. It's my pleasure to introduce my friend and colleague, Matt Miller.
Thanks, Lenny, and welcome to everyone. I'm delighted to be here, and as capitalism collapses all around us, I can think of no better place to be than at Stanford to discuss the future of healthcare. I noticed in various conversations, both in the hallways and even at our own table, people talking about their portfolios, wondering how the market was going to close today, et cetera. These are understandable jitters. We meet in a kind of auspicious week. Although I'd suggest that in these tumultuous times, there is a certain security to be found in the healthcare debate. You know, Lehman Brothers may be gone today. AIG may be gone tomorrow. But you can count on the challenge of improving healthcare while lowering costs to be with us for years, so we should take heart. This is something we can cling to even amidst changing times. Now, in all seriousness, even as some of today's developments are grave, and obviously between the market gyrations and the housing woes affecting many Americans, these are very serious times. I think somewhere in our hearts we know that this episode economically will pass, but it's certain that the healthcare challenge that we face, the long-term healthcare challenge, is going to remain one of America's greatest economic threats as well as opportunities, as President Hennessy said, in the years and even in the decades ahead. Now, you all know the litany of woes that our system faces. We're currently spending about 16% of GDP in the U.S. We're told that that's on track to 20% of GDP in just a few years. The rest of the advanced world is somewhere around 10 or 11%. We have nearly 50 million Americans uncovered. They managed to cover everyone. And we've got these huge regional swings, huge variations in the utilization intensity of healthcare services and practices and procedures that absolutely are astonishing and which suggest to, I think, most thoughtful observers that there is radical inefficiency in our healthcare system. Radical inefficiency. Now, you all know the practical problem facing reformers as well, which is that every dollar of healthcare waste is somebody's dollar of income. I think it was John Maynard Keynes, the great British economist, who had a line that I'll butcher a little bit, but it was something to the effect that it's exceedingly difficult to get a man to believe in something if his income depends on his not believing it. And I think as we face the healthcare debate and efforts to both improve quality while lowering costs, there are aspects of that that we just can't ignore in terms of how we deal with the big challenges in moving the nation forward. Now, today, our plan is to dig into the ways that innovation can help us break some of these Gordian knots, and not just in the United States, but also across the globe, because we'll spend some time on the developing world and innovation in that aspect as well. To help us, we have a truly distinguished group of leaders and thinkers from healthcare, from business, from government, and from the nonprofit world to help us make sense of this all. Our focus is going to be on the long term, so this will differ a little bit from your typical inside the beltway conversation. We're not concerned about next month or even next year so much as we're concerned about how to move the system in a more constructive way over the longer term, although rest assured we have imported some very able and distinguished Washington insiders, if only to assure anthropological diversity at this conference. Now, needless to say, on the campaign trail, our subject is getting the kind of deep substantive attention we've come to expect from those who would lead us. So I should say in that regard that it has been declared by our conference sponsors that this is going to be a lipstick on a pig-free zone for the entire afternoon. If you were expecting or looking forward to panels on Barack Obama's plan to bring better sex education to kindergartners across America, or on John McCain's dreams of finally being able to get on the internet, you're in the wrong place. Instead, what I hope may sound like reasonable goals for this afternoon are several. I think we want to try and advance the right conversations to help make some light bulbs hopefully flash on for those of us here in the room and people's minds, to make some connections among ideas that people hadn't appreciated or really understood before, so that the collective talent in this room can move forward on the agenda that we all know we need and that we all know, if you look at the facts, ought to be doable, which is to be able to improve the quality of American healthcare while simultaneously lowering its costs, or at least slowing its growth, the growth of those costs. And if we can wrap this all up by 6 o'clock and get ourselves a drink, we'll have done a good day's work. So to start us off, we're going to hear from the leader who's really one of the reasons we're together to toast his institution today, and that is Dr. Alan Garber. Now, the full bio of Alan Garber is in your materials, but just briefly, Alan's the Henry J. Kaiser Professor at Stanford, where he's also Professor of Medicine and Professor by courtesy of Economics, Health Research, and Policy, and of Economics in the Grad School of Business. He's been director of both the university's Center for Health Policy and the Center for Primary Care and Outcomes Research at the School of Medicine since their founding, hence our toast today. He's also a staff physician at the VA Palo Alto Healthcare System, associate director of the VA Center for Healthcare Evaluation, and director of the healthcare program at the National Bureau of Economic Research. I mean, in total, Alan's got more titles, honors, degrees, and leadership roles than I could possibly keep track of. On a personal level, I'm glad to count Alan as a friend and, as importantly, as a reliable source when I am writing about healthcare on deadline. Alan is always insightful and can be insightful on deadline, which is a rare commodity. Alan's going to kick us off with a typically unambitious set of remarks on zero growth in healthcare expenditures, after which he's going to leave a few minutes for questions and answers on what I'm sure is going to be a very stimulating presentation. Please join me in welcoming Alan Garber.
Thank you, Matt, and I'd like to thank John Hennessy and Lenny Mendonca for their wonderful introductions. We're trying to minimize today how much time we spend reminiscing about the centers because I think all of us are deeply interested in the issues that are facing us today. I do want to make a couple of brief comments before I launch into my talk. John had talked about the, this, uh, the center's being a Stanford institution and the kinds of work that we do, and I have to say that the kinds of work we do and the way we do it aren't really possible in the same way in other academic environments. And the reason is that Stanford has for many, many years, decades actually made it a policy to promote interdisciplinary research in ways that have actually been very, very successful, not only in our little area, but in huge areas like the BioX initiative and throughout the information sciences. I'm going to be offering a lot of thanks today, but for now I just want to recognize three very important people who are really the intellectual fathers of these centers at Stanford. And this is the other reason that our centers would not exist in another academic environment. I think that you know these three people. Two of them are here today. On the left is Kenneth Arrow, who I think it was in the 60s, was approached by an officer at the Ford Foundation, who is the gentleman on the right, Victor Fuchs, who suggested that he write a book, an article about health economics. And it has become perhaps the single great classic among all journal articles in health economics, Uncertainty in the Welfare Economics of Medical Care. A longtime Stanford faculty member, Ken has, of course, is Nobel Prize winner, has basically founded three subfields of economics, and has been an intellectual inspiration to me, at least, since my undergraduate days. Alan Antoven in the middle here is the father, known as the father of managed competition, who has been another tremendous intellectual resource for the entire university. He's an emeritus business school professor. All three of them are emeriti. And I have to add in passing that on the occasion of Victor Fuchs' retirement, Don Kennedy made a memorable remark that in recognizing Fuchs' retirement, he felt like he was participating in a fraud. And indeed, all three of these academic leaders have continued to be extraordinarily active. And in Alan's case, he was the author of the Committee on Economic Development's health reform plan with tremendous influence throughout the country, and I think you'll see even more influence if we have an extended healthcare reform debate after the fall. And on the right, Victor Fuchs, who has been my mentor for many years, is often known as the father of health economics, has been really an inspiration not only to the members of the center, but to physicians, health economists, and policymakers around the world. Could I ask Alan and Vic to please stand for a moment? I think Ken is not here, but if I overlooked you, please stand too. But anyway, I just want to add that if it had not been for them, not only would our centers not exist in their current form, but Stanford would not be the tremendous university that it is. Now, I had a lot of trouble in thinking about this talk. I've been thinking about the subject of my talk for roughly 30 years. And this is the title I started with, How to Make Deep Cuts in Health Expenditures. Somehow my heart got a little bit weak along the way. That sounded a little too ambitious, so how to cut health expenditures. At least we can maybe make a dent, tackle what Matt has termed this radical inefficiency. My heart failed me a little bit there, too. So I made it a little more modest, and this is what I think we had in the agenda, thinking the unthinkable, zero growth in health expenditures. Well, I decided I'm actually going to have to justify my title, so I made one more change. Reduce growth in health expenditures. So we're going to set the bar, I hope, not too low, but also not impossibly high. I actually think there is a possibility of zero growth in health expenditures, but today let me just say that's beyond my pay grade. Now, I'm working from an assumption that we all agree that we should be concerned about rising health expenditures, and that's in many circles taken as a fairly legitimate, unexceptionable idea. But there are many of us who believe it's really about value. That is, we wouldn't be so concerned about rising health expenditures if we thought we were getting great value. Murphy and Topel, two University of Chicago economists, have tried to tally up the economic value of the increase in life expectancy that Americans have experienced since 1970. And they calculated it was worth $95 trillion, which is three times health spending, a great investment by any means, and certainly better than most debt instruments. The improvements in health and functioning that are not reflected in life expectancy have also been highly valuable. Think about something like cataract operations. If you take a person with cataracts who is near blind and you restore their vision through a cataract operation, you have essentially no effect on the length of their lives, but a tremendous effect on the quality of life. So that's not reflected in these statistics, and it turns out that cataract operations are enormously cost-effective. And this is an example of the numbers where these statements come from. This shows what happened to female life expectancy at age 65 since 1970, and I am sorry that the font's small, but it rose from about 17 years to 20 years over that 33-year period in the U.S. Now, I could show you life expectancy at birth. I could show you life expectancy at age 40 or 45. I happen to choose this one because age 65 is an age where life expectancy depends much more on medical care than at those other ages, where you have confounding from things like at birth, for example, prenatal care, behavior, all kinds of other things. But it turns out anyway that the life expectancy trends are similar across all demographic groups in the U.S., men and women. There's a problem if you're starting to feel good about our track record here, which is that we're not the only ones who've experienced these gains in life expectancy. This slide shows in the straw color life expectancy for American women age 65, and the pink colored bars are for women, the average in Canada, France, Germany, Japan, and the UK. So I selected large countries roughly comparable to the US in wealth, and also countries for which data happen to be available. But in any case, this shows you the trends over time, and not only have they experienced similar gains in life expectancy, theirs have been larger. So in fact, if anything, the relative position of U.S. women has slipped compared to these other countries over that period of time. And the same is true of men, where U.S. men in 1970 experienced life expectancy at age 65 that was a little bit larger than in the other countries, and it was the other countries ended up a little bit ahead. This by itself might not be such a devastating set of facts were it not for the other fact that you're all aware of, what's happened to per capita health spending. And here, the pink bars are the other countries' health spending in U.S. dollars, constant U.S. dollars using purchasing power parity to make them comparable, and the blue bars in the U.S. So going back to 1970 and even farther back, we've spent more per capita than the other countries. But the gap between U.S. expenditures and expenditures in the other countries has increased steadily over time. So now we spend about twice as much. And in fact, if you were to compare the U.S. to all the OECD countries, the Organization of Economic Cooperation and Development, that's the wealthy countries of the world, we stand at about double their average, their per capita healthcare spending. So where's the value? Now, I happen to think value is really important, but I have to confess, if you want to be realistic, it's also about the money. Even if we were getting value for our money, there would be concerns about how much we're spending. And I'm going to just present one nightmare slide. Peter Orszag can tell you far more authoritatively about this, and he'll probably also tell you that my slide is too optimistic. And this shows projected Medicare expenditures. This is according to the Medicare trustees. These are calculated by the actuaries and CMS. As a percentage of gross domestic product over the coming years. So the top of the curve here represents total projected Medicare expenditures. It's supposed to be essentially a straight line extrapolation based on demographic change fairly conservative assumptions about prices and so on. Everybody who has a W-2 has a line on there for the Medicare tax, or the hospital insurance tax. That goes into the hospital insurance trust fund, and that's what's labeled in blue at the bottom, payroll taxes. For Medicare Part B, so that goes for Medicare Part A, Medicare Part B, that is the physician services component of Medicare, requires payment of premiums, but the premiums cover varying percentages of the costs of providing those Part B services, and it might be 20% to 30% of the total cost. So the Part B premiums and the Part D, that is the premiums for the drug benefit, are what comprise this green area here. You can think of everything in blue and orange above that as an unfunded liability. That is, money that will have to be spent to pay the bill for Medicare that does not have a dedicated source of revenue. So that unfunded liability, if you look here at 2050, will amount to approximately 6% of GDP. 6% of the total output of goods and services in the U.S. economy in 2050 if these trends continue. And to put this in perspective, there's one other fact to keep in mind, which is that the number of working Americans per elderly American will shrink over that time. So just a few years ago, there were 4 workers for every elderly American. And sometime later this century, there will only be 2. And the liability will be $7,600 per working age adult, and that's in 2008 dollars. And to put this in perspective, the individual income tax per working age adult is, in 2006, inflated to 2008 dollars, was about $6,300. So if you were to pay for this out of the individual income tax, it would represent basically a more than doubling. So I leave it to you to think about how we might pay for that. We happen to have a project that's looking at this, but all I can say is it's not going to be easy to close that gap with taxation mechanisms. So why do we spend so much? I think you all know what the answers are, what we usually think of as the causes, and the first, and this is true consistently when you compare us to other countries, is that our prices are high. They're pretty much high across the board. What you usually hear about are drug prices, but the amount of physician reimbursement per unit of service tends to be higher in the U.S. than in other countries. Hospital costs are higher. And part of this is just essentially price levels. It's really amazing what people will put up on the web. I happen to just find this using a Google image search at somebody's emergency room visit, and you see that it costs about $4,000, and incidentally, that's not just charges. That's approximately what was paid. And if this person happened to have a CT of the abdomen and pelvis for this emergency room visit, I have no idea whether it was appropriate, but the fact that it costs $1,200 makes this an American bill. $1,200 for each, I should say. It's just continuing the slices a little farther down when you go from abdomen to pelvis, so it's really like a $2,400 procedure. So the prices are higher. There's not much dispute about that. And then, of course, there are administrative costs, everyone's favorite villain. And we can all agree, I believe, that administrative costs in the U.S. are higher, but you'll have a damn hard time trying to figure out how much higher, because it's one set of costs that's almost impossible to measure consistently, even within the U.S., much less across countries. But in administrative costs, people usually think about things like marketing health insurance plans, processing bill payments, and so on and so forth. And the estimates range anywhere from 5% or 10% of health expenditures up to 30%. And one of the things that this image suggests is another one of our problems is we're behind in IT adoption. And there's not a lot of doubt about that. Let me just show you regarding administrative costs. This is from a publication by the Congressional Research Service, and it shows different countries. And I have to tell you about one aspect of looking at these international comparative statistics. John Skinner of Dartmouth and I have just put out a paper called "Is U.S. Healthcare Uniquely Inefficient?" And when we tried to answer that question, we discovered if you look at every dimension of being bad, any dimension, there will be some country that's worse than us, but it will always be a different country. So we're almost always in second place, and all I can say is thank God for Luxembourg. So that's about 10% according to their estimates. And some of the differences you'll see in the administrative cost estimates has to do with what they include as administrative costs. So there's a significant amount of money there, presumably. And here we can say, thank God for Canada. This is a measure of adoption of electronic health records in primary care offices, only 28% in the U.S. And you look at the Netherlands and New Zealand, and they're up pretty close to 100% adoption. So we're laggards in that way. Then there are the misaligned incentives. The fact that when you go to see the doctor, a doctor in the office, try to see a gastroenterologist, though. One of my fellows is a gastroenterologist. I don't mean to pick on them. But good luck having a long discussion about your GI problem if it's not going to lead to a procedure. And, of course, the problem is that's what they get paid for doing. And guess what happens when you pay people for doing procedures? They do a lot of them, right? So this is from the same Commonwealth Fund survey that looked at whether primary care doctors were being rewarded for providing better care, for the quality of their care. And only 30% of U.S. primary care physicians answered yes. The U.K. is up near 100%. So they're not incentivized to do the things like make sure there are fewer medical errors, to hit clinical goals, say get the hemoglobin A1C down for their diabetic patients. They have professional reasons for doing it. They have ethical reasons for doing it, but they don't have much in the way of financial incentives. And that leads to this phenomenon. For those of you who can't read the caption here, the doctor is saying, well, Bob, it looks like a paper cut, but just to be sure, let's do lots of tests. So that's what you get when you pay for tests. And here, thank goodness for Japan, we're number two in number of MRI units per million population at nearly 27. Japan has 35. And I have to add that I studied Japan earlier in my career. And Japan had more CT scanners, too. But the interesting thing is that they didn't spend as much because although the Japanese physicians were ordering lots and lots of CT scans, they weren't getting paid very much for each one. So the total expenditures were actually lower than in the U.S. I don't know the data for MRIs. So the big challenge is, can we cut the costs if we recognize some of these leading causes? I think the real challenge is not really cutting costs, but is there a politically viable way to cut costs? And this is where we have run into trouble time and time again. This is one reason why I was so delighted to be able to invite some of our colleagues from Washington who know far more about this than those of us here in La La Land do. So one thing that's politically very attractive is to promote electronic health records. Electronic health records are irresistible. They have a high-tech ring. Doesn't sound like it costs much, and it's pretty obvious that care should be better if you can actually find the patient's chart when you see the patient. Working at the VA, where this is actually, by the way, a snapshot of VISTA, which is the VA's electronic health record. And before VISTA was implemented in the VA, one time they did a survey and they found out that we only had patient charts 40% of the time when the patient showed up in clinic. And now we have it essentially 100% of the time. So if for no other reason that you actually have the information available, this has to be a good thing. The other thing about it is it sounds like it's costless, so that's really attractive. Now, I'm trying to be completely nonpartisan, and I'm going to mention some of the savings that Obama's supporters have claimed. That has nothing to do with Obama versus McCain. Most of these numbers have not been produced, to my knowledge, by the McCain campaign, but I don't think there's actually a lot of disagreement about whether these are good things between the parties. So the Obama advisors are claiming that we can save $77 billion a year this way. The Lewin Group, who did some estimates for the Commonwealth Fund, are looking at a significantly smaller number. Reducing administrative costs. This sounds like a great, great idea. And I have to tell you that the most cited estimates of administrative cost savings are from longtime single-payer advocates who have urged a Canadian-style healthcare system for the U.S. And their numbers, of course, are extremely high. And one of the questions is, well, how exactly would you achieve this if you had a single payer? Would you really reduce administrative costs that much? The Obama advisors are thinking, well, we'll disintermediate insurance brokers. The brokers get a cut. They sell insurance. If you have exchanges, to buy insurance like the Federal Employees Health Benefits Program. They'll cut out a lot of that, and you could get savings this large. But the kinds of things you would do to reduce administrative costs vary greatly with the plan, and none of us really know exactly how much you could save. And then there's prevention and disease management. I don't want to say a lot about this. You see the numbers that are claimed here. I just want to note one thing, that I've been involved in the issue of health reform for a long time, and everybody says they want to promote prevention. It turns out Milt Weinstein and Peter Newman, two economists in Boston, have actually taken a look at the cost effectiveness of different interventions. And there's, in their review, prevention is actually no more cost effective than cure when you take all of the range of things that you could do into account. Some forms of prevention are great. Some forms of treatment, like the cataract operations I mentioned earlier, are also high-value uses of money. But this is something everybody loves. You don't really have to explain it to the voter when you say you're for prevention. You might think of this as sort of a catchphrase, but what they really mean is that we want to promote cost-effective care. Now, I've tried to talk about things that are politically easy to swallow, and now we're going to get into somewhat more controversial ideas. One is comparative effectiveness, and this is the idea of providing better information about what works. Providing better information is not really controversial. What's controversial is how the information will be used, and that's why Congress has never passed legislation to create a Center for Medical Effectiveness or for comparative effectiveness, different terms are used. But this was viewed by the Lewin Associates as providing fairly substantial savings. Another thing is to align payment incentives, and what that means is to pay doctors and hospitals for improving outcomes. And typically that means instead of paying on a piece rate basis for each test, for each procedure that's done, you'd look at how a patient with, say, congestive heart failure is managed. You might give them an overall payment for managing the patient for a month or an episode of disease or something like that. And it leaves the decisions about which services to use in the hands of the physicians or the hospitals or the provider group. This would be, I believe, extremely controversial given the record of success in implementing the scheduled pay cuts in Medicare. If this has income consequences for different groups of providers, it's going to be tough to do. And then improved health insurance markets. This would mean something like creating markets like the Federal Employee Health Benefits Program that everybody could buy insurance from. That's been part of both Democratic and Republican proposals. It's a great idea. It's not clear how much that would save. And then limiting the health insurance tax exclusion. Alan Antoven has been a longtime advocate for limiting the tax exclusion. This means, of course, that if the employer pays for health insurance, it's not included as taxable income. And the employee contributions are also excluded from taxable income. And the people who benefit the most from this exclusion are, of course, the people who spend the most. It's sort of like a regressive subsidy that benefits the higher income people more. And most economists would say this is the single cause of healthcare cost inflation if you were to identify any one factor. This has probably the least chance of success, but the reason I put question marks here is not because of doubts about whether it be passed. It's because the savings that result depend very much on the specific form the limit would take. One simple and obvious point to make, though, when you contemplate how we might cut expenditures and cut expenditure growth, is the things that might cut expenditures are not necessarily the things that will cut expenditure growth. And what I mean by that is there are certain approaches you could take that will yield one-time savings but do very little about the growth rate. So, for example, take administrative costs. Unless you believe that administrative costs are the prime driver behind rising health expenditures, if you cut administrative costs, you will reduce expenditures, but you will leave the rate of growth untouched. Think about drug prices. This is this is red meat for certain segments of the population. Drug prices are too high. We can lower drug prices. Well, first of all, drugs account for roughly 10% of the healthcare dollar. The exact percentage varies year to year. If you cut prices, the only way it's going to really affect the rate of growth is if it chokes off innovation and the introduction of new drugs. But otherwise, you're going to see what amounts to a one-time savings. Incidentally, if you cut the 10%, by 20%, so you're left with a 2% reduction, and that's one of the difficulties with focusing on any one element like that. So I want to make a few comments about what I see as the central issue for controlling expenditure growth, that is, sustained reductions in expenditures, and that's going to require some rethinking in which we judge interventions by the value they provide, not simply the health benefit. In other words, look at whether they're delivering value for the money. Now, we happen to have techniques for doing this. This is a major focus of our centers. This is an example of the application of cost-effectiveness analysis. I've chosen the example of COX-2 inhibitors, first of all, because it's very familiar to you, but it helps to show you some of the advantages you can derive from approaching this problem, even when you don't have complete information, using a technique this way. So COX-2 inhibitors, of course, reduce the risk of GI bleeding in people who need treatment for arthritis pain or other forms of pain. Non-steroidal anti-inflammatory drugs are drugs like naproxen, Advil. Naproxen is also known as Aleve. And this is a study that basically estimated what would happen to overall costs for treating a patient, say, with chronic arthritis, with naproxen or a COX-2 inhibitor. And when the study was done, there was a lot of controversy about whether there are any adverse effects of the treatment, the COX-2s, on heart health. And what this showed was that the cost per quality-adjusted life year, that's a common measure, the main measure used in cost-effectiveness analysis, it's a measure of overall health, the cost per quality-adjusted life year was nearly $300,000, which is a very high number by almost any standard. In the U.S., we might say up to $100,000 is acceptable. If you took into account the effects on the heart, which were suspected then, but it was controversial, it looked worse, of course. The COX-2s could cause heart attacks. Now, the COX-2s were initially approved for the treatment of patients who are at high risk for GI bleeding, meaning they'd been treated with something like naproxen before and had had a major GI bleed. They're at high risk for bleeding again if they're treated with the same drug. And in this group, not only was it cost effective, but it would be worth, this is not shown in this study, but it would be worth treating these patients despite the heart attack risk because the reduction in the risk of bleeding more than outweighed the increase in risk of heart disease. So this kind of approach not only helps you establish what's high value and what's low value, but it gives you some much more refined information. It addresses the question of high value in whom, or low value in whom, and in whom is the risk too great to justify the benefit. This has tremendous consequences for overall expenditures if you move to a value-based criterion of this kind. This is a study, I'm sorry for the size of the print here, that was conducted out of RAND. Jay Bhattacharya and I were collaborators, and it was led by one of our former students, in which they tried to project what new technologies would become available over the next 10 to 25 years, and they convened groups of experts. And one of these technologies is already available. I don't know if you can see that blue area. It says LVADs. Those are left ventricular assist devices. It's a form of artificial heart. This works. It's been proven in one really well-designed trial to prolong life in people with extremely severe forms of congestive heart failure. The problem is that they're kept alive, but at least in the early studies, they had a lot of hospital use, and in fact, spent a lot of time in ICUs. And in our studies of the cost-effectiveness of this device, looking at data from some health plans, the costs ran up anywhere between $250,000 to $900,000 a year to keep these patients alive. It's not that the device was so expensive. That's just what it cost to keep them alive. So this has a cost-effectiveness ratio of over $500,000. The total budget impact on Medicare, it's not huge, but it's a very small number of people. Now, here's something that will warm your hearts. The anti-aging compound, Healthy. And let me explain what that is. How many of you have heard of resveratrol? So you know resveratrol is the, I'm not quite sure how to describe it, but it's the miracle drug, or not resveratrol itself, but its analogs, we hope will do this, that'll make you live just as long as if you just starve yourself all the time. You're probably aware that lab animals, and we think humans, if they're kept on a near-starvation diet, will live a lot longer, and also they're healthier. They're less prone to get arthritis, diabetes, other chronic diseases. And what resveratrol does in animals is makes well-fed animals live just as long as those who are kept on a near-starvation diet and just as healthily. So this is kind of a fountain of youth. And incidentally, you probably know that we are offering resveratrol in the form of some very nice red wine at the reception. The only problem is one of you would probably have to drink our entire wine supply to get the right dose of resveratrol. But in any case, this is something that looks like it's expensive because everybody would be treated at age 65, about $50 billion a year in 2015. But it's keeping people healthy, so there's a lot of offset in future health expenditures, and the cost per additional life year is very low, around $8,800. So this is the Holy Grail. And the question is, can we design a health system that will promote this kind of technology over LVADs? And let me just add as an aside, I don't mean to pick on LVADs because I think LVADs and the devices that are descended from them are undoubtedly going to get much better and cheaper in the future and look much more attractive. This is based on what we know now. So I have two steps, not two easy steps, but two steps to reduce expenditure growth. The first is better financing and payment. And I'm not going to go into a lot of detail about this. These are my closing comments. And we're going to hear a lot more about payment in particular later today from some genuine experts who have thought about this very deeply and in very original ways. But we're going to have to learn how to pay for what we want to get from our healthcare system. And if we want health outcomes, we're going to have to discover how to incentivize providers to improve health outcomes. I've always been a skeptic about direct subsidy of IT investments because I think providers will make the IT investments if they're rewarded for producing better outcomes. You can't imagine getting there without significant IT investments. And there are institutional, regulatory, and historical barriers to implementing more effective payment mechanisms. We're going to have to figure our way around that. Better information is critical. And one reason I'm closing on better information is that better information is something that's really attainable. It requires some expenditures, relatively modest, in comparison to what we spend on healthcare. This is something we can do, and it looks like it might be something we can do politically. You know, we basically went through my Rolodex to figure out the invitation list here, and I'm so delighted that so many of my friends are here and our friends collectively. Many, many of you are innovators. Some of you are inventors, some entrepreneurs, some venture capitalists. Some of you are faculty who have been involved in innovation. And one thing that's on all of our minds is how can we make sure that innovation continues to be rewarded? I happen to think that innovation will continue to be rewarded, but the criteria by which innovations will be judged will shift. It will no longer be an additional month of life expectancy at $80,000 or $100,000. It's going to much more focus on highly efficient technologies that, if they don't reduce costs, at least increase them in a way that's reasonable in relation to the health benefits provided. So I'm actually optimistic about the future, and I look forward to hearing with the rest of you the ideas that will come out in the afternoon sessions. Thank you very much.
So Alan has kindly agreed to take some questions, and we've got time for that. There are people with microphones running around the room who can bring you a microphone to ask your question. It would be great if you just tell us who you are, and if you have an institutional affiliation you want to share, that's great, and tell us your question. So do I see a hand? I see this gentleman over here, if there's a microphone that can get to him.
Hi, thank you. I'm Charles Hsu, a partner with Bay City Capital, a venture capital firm. You rightly point out that information technology is an area where our sector has been practically regressive compared with other industries. I see some fellow VCs in the room. I think most of us probably would agree that investments in healthcare information systems have been an absolute graveyard for venture capitalists since this industry has been around, which would suggest that a solution might require non-market mechanisms for it to work. I'm just wondering what you would, how you would address that proposition.
Well, that's a great question. I hope everybody heard the question. I've been on both sides of this question, having been involved in a firm that did not make as much money, I think, as the investors thought it would, that was trying to deliver a better way for physicians and patients to communicate, and as a provider. And the question is that we physicians always ask is, where is the lesion? Is the lesion that there's difficulty with capital to purchase IT? Is the lesion a lack of standards? And I think both of those things matter, but what matters the most is that the business case for many providers isn't there. That is to invest in information technology. And the reason it isn't there is they look at this as a big capital outlay. They may exaggerate how big an outlay it is, by the way, but that's what they think of it as. And they don't see the payoff, and this is why I keep getting back to incentivize providers the right way. Once you have to, in real time, present information about how your patients are doing, there is no alternative but to make the IT investment. This should be funded through the payment system, though, not through direct subsidy of IT.
Another question? Do we have another hand? I see this lady over here.
I just wanted to know if you could follow up a little bit on what you said were some of the barriers to getting physicians to invest in technology.
To getting physicians to invest in technology?
Well, to get technology into the physician's office. Are you talking about the Stark laws? Are you talking about privacy? Or what are your concerns?
Oh, well, those are certainly raised. To get when you're talking about information technology, I don't think the Stark laws are a big issue for them. But it's very simple. The standards part, by the way, is that physicians and hospitals live in fear of investing a huge amount in technology and then having it become obsolete in a couple of years, especially if it's going to be incompatible with whatever they want to replace it with. But it's in some cases, what we had found in the firm that I was working with was that you have to change your entire clinical processes around the IT. And that's a much bigger job than installing software and hardware. And fundamentally, what they're up against is what seems like a complex and in some ways nebulous task, that is how to figure out optimizing one's practice around IT. And again, if you get payment that rewards things like results, that I believe there's almost always a good business case to be made at the provider level. I don't see the main issue for the adoption of information technology to be regulatory. Although that is a huge issue for sharing of information, but that's a whole different topic.
I see this gentleman over on my left over here first.
Herbert Abrams, Stanford Medical School. In the manner of keeping costs down, you didn't mention capping costs. As in, for example, Great Britain. If you cap costs, you obviously have a fixed budget. You can't go beyond that. And the VA, to some extent, may represent that. Would you elaborate on that?
Well, I didn't talk about capping costs because to cap costs, you do need one budget, which all the money goes through. And let me tell you a story from long ago in our VA. At the end of the year, the I hope nobody's going to quote me on this, but this is a long time ago, and the principals are no longer around. But a long time ago, we overran the pharmacy budget, and we also overran the diet budget. So around November, the then head of the hospital decreed that we would only refill generic drugs, and back then there weren't as many generic drugs as there are today. And they simplified the diet so that there used to be something like 14 or 16 different diets that inpatients could use. And they decided that they'd kind of go for the most common denominator, that is a diet everybody could take. So it was a soft foods, low salt diet. I don't know if any of you have ever tried one of those. It gets tiresome pretty quickly, especially if your teeth are okay. So Seriously, the concept of a global cap on the healthcare budget implies that you have a system where you have a single budget, and even Medicare can't really do that. That is, the bills come in, you have a reimbursement formula, and then you have to pay it. Now, Japan has an interesting setup where in years past they did sort of have a global budget. If utilization went up, and what they did is they had something like an RVRVS, a relative value scale, and the multiplier would go down so that they'd bring it for the following year. So in other words, if they overspent by 10% 1 year, they'd apply a new formula that reduced costs by 10%. Somehow, I don't think anybody in any other country has managed to keep their budgets in control the way they want, despite the talk about capping a budget. And we have an international project that involves about 18 advanced nations, and all of them were struggling with how to control their health care costs. So I don't think it's a magic bullet, even in a system that ostensibly allows global caps.
I saw this gentleman over here.
Alan, Phil Lee. You didn't mention capitated prepaid group practice, and we've known probably for 50 years that that can significantly reduce costs. And then Alan has advocated managed competition since the mid-1970s, again, with substantial potential savings, well above in some of the figures that you've cited. Would you comment on the managed competition notion?
Well, Phil, thanks for that question. I'm a huge fan of managed competition, and I see that as part of the solution. Managed competition is one thing, and capitated health plans are another. Capitated health plans can be part of managed competition, and the conundrum we've faced is, as Phil said, that capitated systems like Kaiser Permanente really are effective at holding down costs, although the rate of growth of costs is similar to the rest of the health sector. So that's an issue that would have to be dealt with. And I meant to include managed competition in this idea of improving the function of health insurance markets. Now, Alan and Sarah Singer, who is here today, who was executive director of Center for Health Policy before she left for the East Coast, and I developed one form of managed competition plan, and it was scored by Lewin Associates, which means they figured out how much the plans would cost and how many more people would be covered. And they wouldn't even give us a 15% savings for managed competition, which got all of us upset, especially Alan. And the problem is we don't have a lot of data to know how big the savings would be from that kind of system. But the big advantage of managed competition is it's an American solution in the sense that it preserves the notion of choice, which it is very clear Americans value very, very highly.
I see this hand over here.
Mark Berger, Eli Lilly. Thanks for your comments, Alan, and I want to pressure test your optimism about continuing incentives for value-enhancing innovation. If there's one thing we finally learned is that even the American public can have its behaviors changed, that when gas prices got high enough, we actually started driving a whole lot less. And what we've seen recently, as the insurance industry has consented to cost shift to patients and more out-of-pocket costs and the rise of fourth tier, is that consumers don't always make the wisest decision from the point of view of their own health benefits, but they make economic choices about whether they're going to even expend some of their discretionary or non-discretionary income for health care. And as the industry is moving towards biologics, which are now increasingly now no longer $1,000 a year, but can be $25,000 a year or $50,000 a year, one can imagine that there is in the not-too-distant future going to be a loss of market confidence that people actually pay for new innovation, whether it be pharmaceuticals or devices or whatever else. And that there might be a decline in that demand or willingness to pay, which can lead to a contraction of our innovation enterprises. Do you want to comment?
Yeah, well, I think that's a very fair set of points, Mark. I'm not sure I can deal with all of them at once. But regarding the issue of cost sharing and what we think of as bad decisions, speaking as physicians anyway, that patients make, you'll notice that I didn't propose as a solution increased cost sharing. I actually think that we might be able to push on that a little bit more, but for the reasons you say, in addition to the fact that most people are going to start to feel at some point that they're not getting protection from risk with their insurance, for those reasons, I don't believe that's an area where we can push much further. But mainly, I think you're challenging my sort of rosy conclusion that innovation will continue to be rewarded. You know, look at the IT industry, which John Hennessy referred to. There have been some subsidies. A lot of the basic technology was developed with Department of Defense contracts. But for the most part, what's gone on has been private investment, and there's no subsidy on the purchasing side. People don't pay for innovation. They pay for products, and they pay for services. And I guess I'm saying that there are going to be innovations in products and services. It can be developed in healthcare, and the people who come up with them will be rewarded. I can't tell you what the total size of the pot will be, but I will tell you that the reason the costs are going up so much, the expenditures over time, is a demographic trend. There are going to be a lot more older people who are going to need health care, and I think that even if we go to a much more strict value-based system, there are going to be tremendous business opportunities, and I know that several people in this room are counting on that, but I don't think they're... I know these people, and I don't think that they're being unreasonable optimists.
You know, one thought that's interesting just related to the speaker's question is Andrew Witty, the new head of GlaxoSmithKline. There have been several news items about the fact that he's sitting down with payers like governments now to kind of preview the pipeline to see what they'd be willing to pay for. It's kind of an interesting evolution in the dynamic. We still have time for a couple of questions. I see this person right here in the center. Can we get a microphone? Right. Raise your hand there, so here we go.
Hi, Idison from UCSF. One of the
inputs... Is the mic on? It's a little hard to hear.
Idison from UCSF. One of the inputs to the whole healthcare system is the physician workforce, and there was an article in JAMA just, I think, last week that 2% of medical school graduates are going to primary care internal medicine, another 5% into family practice. Even as the population is getting older, the burden of chronic disease is getting higher, you know where this is going. With some data showing that primary care physicians do deliver care that's more cost-effective, fewer hospitalizations, and so forth, can you comment on the role of the physician workforce, specifically specialty mix, in reducing cost?
Yeah, so this question about the physician workforce, as Ida Weld knows, she and I are both general internists, and I try to stay away from my parochial concerns, but not too many general internists these days are very happy about how reimbursement affects them, because they, for the most part, don't have a procedure, and because they don't have a procedure, they can't bill the same way a lot of their physician colleagues can. I'm on a committee at the Association of American Medical Colleges, and they pushed the idea of workforce intervention. So we have these loan programs, for example, to get people going to primary care, to get them to go into underserved areas. You know, physicians are actually pretty good at making financial calculations, and they figure a $20,000 subsidy today can't make up for a $1 million lifetime shortfall in income. So that's why I keep stressing the incentives. The reason that not many people are going into primary care is they can't make money doing it, and the reason they can't make money doing it is simply because it's not reimbursed very well. There's a lot of politics in Washington revolving around this concept of medical home to they're designed to address that issue. But again, physicians respond just like anybody else does to financial incentives, and they're just not being rewarded under the current system.
We have time for another. We have, I see one right over here.
Hi, Don Barr from Stanford. And Alan, I'd like to recall the episode a few years ago when there was a contaminant in one of the flu vaccine manufacturers. And suddenly we had half of the flu vaccines that we needed. And so a batch of flu vaccines were assigned to a provider, the Palo Alto Medical Foundation or a county, and they said, you guys, the providers, decide which patients need the vaccines the most, because this is all there are. Is there a feasible way in Medicare, do you think, from a policy perspective, through the idea of a medical home or other types of assignment of Medicare patients to a identified group, that Medicare will say, okay, this is how much you have to take care of your Medicare patients. Make sure you do it the most cost-effective way.
Well, that's a great question, Don. Thank you. In a way, you could say that already exists in Medicare Advantage. What gets the publicity today is the high growth area of Medicare Advantage. These are what used to be known as Medicare Plus Choice plans. And what gets the attention is the fee-for-service plans that are basically duplicating Medicare coverage. But there's also the Medicare Managed Care. So you can enroll in a capitated plan, and they're trying to do exactly what you described, Don, although possibly at a larger level. The big problem is many of these are not capitation the way you and I might think it should function. We have in mind Kaiser. A lot of these are commercial HMOs that don't work the same way. The problem with that approach, which I happen to think in theory is great, is that people aren't choosing it. There's a group of people who will choose it, but that the size of that group has not grown by very much over the years. And you would think now is the time when more and more people would be interested, but it's hard to get people into that arrangement. But I agree. In principle, this addresses a lot of the problems.
Time for, I think, one last question probably here. I see this gentleman over here.
Philip Alper, clinical faculty, UCSF, practicing physician, and recent Hoover visiting scholar. Alan, you showed a slide about primary care physicians and information technology adoption, with the implication that more information technology adoption would be very helpful. I've been wondering whether or not, pardon me, it would be highly inflationary. And the reason being that you make very many things visible that are less than visible now. The assumption is that by making things visible and doing something about them, you get higher quality care, which may well be true. But since a variety of specialties contribute the markers that we're going to measure and the frequency that they're supposed to be done, with no regard to one another, the global net result will be doctors be running around to do everything they're, quote, supposed to, without generating necessarily an equivalent amount of value.
Yeah, well, that's anytime you give doctors a better tool, there's always a possibility to be used in ways that you don't anticipate, and that's why I have to emphasize again, that problem arises if you can't get the incentives right and the doctors know way more than the payers do. Certainly you can get these kinds of unanticipated consequences, but I wouldn't blame the tool for that. That really has to do with, do you design the incentives the right way?
Well, Alan Garber, I think, has given us a lot to think about as we begin our afternoon. We are going to take a 15-minute break and resume at 1:45 sharp with Peter Orszag. In the meantime, please join me in thanking Alan Garber for teeing us off with these thoughtful questions. Welcome back. We're in for a treat now, because Peter Orszag, for those of you who don't know him or his role, is arguably the most powerful man in Washington. As director of the Congressional Budget Office, Peter is literally at the center of every important debate that's happening in the federal government and the country today, whether it's from the fate of Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac, to the debates over cap and trade and climate change and energy reform, to obviously the healthcare debate that's at the heart of our concerns today, because all of these issues have dramatic federal budget implications and involve questions of long-term stewardship of the nation's resources. And Peter is one of the leading official guardians of the national interest in that respect. And we couldn't be more fortunate as a country to have someone who's as talented an analyst and thoughtful an intellectual leader as Peter Orszag in that position. He's the seventh director of the CBO. His four-year term began in January of 2007. Before assuming his current role, Dr. Orszag was the Joseph Peckman Senior Fellow and Deputy Director of Economic Studies at the Brookings Institution. While he was at Brookings, many of you are probably aware he was director of the Hamilton Project, which provides a platform for scholars to offer proposals for promoting broad-based economic growth He also ran a number of other projects there in terms of tax policy and retirement security, and has published leading-edge papers and analyses in virtually every aspect of domestic and economic public policy and politics. He served in the CEA before that. You've got his full resume, obviously, in your materials. And Peter is going to offer us a federal perspective on health care policy and costs. Please join me in welcoming Peter Orszag.
Good afternoon. I'm delighted to be here. For those of you who want the Cliff Notes version of my talk, I'm going to make two basic points. One is that healthcare costs are the key to our fiscal future. And as Alan Garber has already pointed out, there seems to be substantial inefficiencies in the health system. And secondly, that just like economics ignored psychology to its peril for too long, I believe too much of healthcare policy and medical science is making the same mistake. So for those of you who just want, again, the very short version, there it is. Let me try to back that up with a little bit more detail. First, on our fiscal future, if you look at this graph, it shows you projected spending over time under our projections. And I think it's immediately obvious that most of the rise in federal spending is coming from the light blue area of that curve, which is Medicare and Medicaid. It is often the case that in popular media discussions, that fact is overlooked and lots of other things are blamed or attributed to our coming fiscal problems. For example, it is common to say that the aging of the baby boom generation is a fiscal tsunami that will bankrupt the country. And it is true that the aging of the population puts upward pressure on our spending path. But that's not the primary thing going on, and I think you might even be able to see that from this graph, since the demographic forces are affecting Social Security along with Medicare and Medicaid, but it's probably pretty obvious from the graph that Social Security does not rise as much as Medicare and Medicaid. Now you may say, well, that's all great, but that's a little trick. Maybe demographic forces are the primary explanation behind the rise in Medicare and Medicaid for reasons that aren't exactly parallel to Social Security. But that's wrong also. This graph takes that light blue area of the curve that I first showed you, and it breaks it into two different components. The first takes the cost for each 65-year-old and 75-year-old and 85-year-old, freezes them in inflation-adjusted terms, and then ages the population as we project it to age. So we're going to have more 85-year-old beneficiaries in the future. That puts upward pressure on costs. If you do that by itself, you get the dark blue area of the curve. I think it's immediately obvious that that's not, again, the bulk of the projected increases in spending. So it's not primarily that we're going to have more 85-year-olds in the future. It's primarily that each 85-year-old in the future will cost us a lot more than they cost us today that causes this upward rise in spending. Now, for those of you who are wondering what that interaction slice is, the fact that we will have more 85-year-olds in the future means that, given that we're going to have higher cost per beneficiary for each 85-year-old, say, in the future, is then spread over a larger number of people, and so these two forces interact with one another. But it's still the case, even if you take that interaction into account, that the primary force or the single most important factor affecting our fiscal future is the rate at which healthcare costs per beneficiary, even on an age-adjusted basis, rise. And the demographic forces are of secondary importance. Another part of this that we need to remember is that that rising cost per beneficiary, or the so-called excess cost growth, which does not necessarily mean excessive, it just means cost growth in excess of income growth, is affecting not only Medicare and Medicaid, but the rest of the healthcare system also. And in fact, if you look over long periods of time, the rate at which healthcare costs per beneficiary have risen in the various parts of the health system have been, on average, between 2 and 2.5 percentage points per year faster than income per capita, and that hasn't varied that much across the different parts of the health system, which is not that surprising, given that hospitals are treating Medicare and non-Medicare patients, Medicaid and non-Medicaid patients. The practice norms that apply to one subset of patients tends to spill over to others, and it would be kind of surprising if we saw dramatically different trends in the different parts of the system. But what this means is if we're going to try to tamp down or bend the curve on Medicare and Medicaid, In order for that change to be sustainable, it needs to induce changes in the overall health system and change the rate at which healthcare costs are growing overall, or we will simply wind up with access problems under those public insurance programs. I would say that Medicare and Medicaid are large enough to lead in that way, and that the rest of the system could follow, like we saw with the introduction of DRG payments in the 1980s, which changed the way hospitals practice medicine, not just for Medicare beneficiaries, but for everyone. But it adds an extra layer of complexity to public policy analysis, because one needs to take into account or think about those follow-on effects. So that all sounds kind of depressing. We've been misdiagnosing the nation's long-term fiscal problem. We can't solve this just within the four corners of Medicare and Medicaid. But before we all get too depressed, I want to highlight something that Alan touched upon, which is the health system seems to contain very substantial inefficiencies. And there's some debate about exactly how large the inefficiencies are, but I think there's little debate about their existence. Perhaps in my mind, the most compelling evidence in favor of that proposition, which has already been referred to, is the very substantial variation in healthcare cost per beneficiary, this is for Medicare spending, that we see across different parts of the United States, which the Dartmouth Group, which has been studying this variation for decades, has not been able to explain based on the underlying health characteristics of the patients in different areas, or the cost of building a hospital in different areas, or doctor salaries in different areas and what have you. For those of you who are politically inclined, I should immediately say that sometimes this graph is presented in blue and sometimes in red. Today it's in blue. The darker blue areas of the country have higher spending per beneficiary than the lower spent than the lighter areas. It's noteworthy to me, we spend a lot of time doing cross-country comparisons in the United States, comparing ourselves to Canada and the UK and what have you. There are large geographic areas of the United States that are delivering health care, those lighter areas up in Minnesota, for example, at the same cost relative to income and at the same, if not better, quality than other countries. And that's happening, this variation is so substantial. It's happening within a single payment system, and it's happening within a single country, that it strikes me as being more productive, perhaps, to examine why this is happening at a much more detailed level than to suffer from all of the difficulties in cross-country comparisons that arise because of different cultural influences and different payment systems and different contexts. So we have been spending a lot of time trying to do that, building off of much of the work that the Dartmouth folks have done. One thing that immediately comes up, and it's appropriate given that I'm speaking at Stanford, is that the darker blue areas of the country do have the nation's leading medical centers in them. But I would immediately say that even at our nation's leading medical centers, there is substantial variation that we can't explain based on existing quality indicators. So, for example, at UCA Medical and at the Mayo Clinic, if you look at the available quality indicators, which are admittedly imperfect, if anything, the Mayo Clinic scores better. This is for Medicare beneficiaries in the last 6 months of life. Cost per beneficiary at UCA Medical, however, is $50,000 a year, and at the Mayo Clinic, $26,000 a year. I would put to you that we are practicing medicine, even at our best medical centers, in dramatically different ways in different parts of the United States. And there is, to my reading of the evidence, little evidence that the extra spending gets us anything in terms of reduced mortality rates or higher quality, raising very substantial questions about why we are spending an extra $24,000 a year of your money at UCA Medical relative to the Mayo Clinic. Now, in an attempt to ingratiate myself with my hosts, I put up this graph, which shows another perspective on the same point. It looks across various academic medical centers for Medicare beneficiaries in the last 6 months of life and looks at the variation in number of days in hospital, which is going to be correlated with spending per beneficiary. And you can see Stanford University Hospital there way at the bottom. And I hope that pleases the people who are hosting this conference, even though perhaps even Stanford is higher than it needs to be. If you look across states on average, there's also no correlation between spending and quality. If anything, the correlation goes the wrong way. And this is going to bring me to my next point. So let me just pause for a second and say we seem to have very substantial opportunities to improve the efficiency of the health system. What is CBO doing to help policymakers try to grapple with that? We have very substantially increased our staff on healthcare. Part of the reason is so that we can do more detailed analysis, and we have had a series of reports coming out on health information technology, on regional variation, and a variety of other topics. We have two massive reports coming out in December where we are taking every basically major thing under discussion, care coordination, disease management, what have you, and we're going to provide more clarity about what CBO thinks the impact will be on the federal budget and on national health expenditures in these two documents. And the goal is to provide more guidance to policymakers. When I took office, one of the complaints that people had was that the CBO scoring process was like a game of battleship, where a senator will say A14, and we say hit, and they say B42, and we say miss, and they have no idea why. They'd send these proposals across and what have you. And so I'm trying to take that shield down in the middle of the battleship game and provide a little bit more information about what the dials, at least from our perspective, are in terms of driving the scoring of proposals. And let me just give you one example on health information technology since Alan brought it up. Health information technology is put forward as this panacea for the health system. And I have two or three things to say about that. The first is that the evidence on the returns to health information technology from a cost perspective as opposed to a quality perspective are mixed at best. And the evidence that they actually by themselves are sufficient, the health information technology investments are sufficient to reduce costs, come most clearly from integrated systems. I see we have some folks from prominent integrated systems with us. And the evidence where you just plop a HIT system in the middle of a non-integrated system with the incentives that we currently face for more care rather than better care, that by itself leads to a reduction in costs, I think are very weak at best. There were some studies that Alan mentioned that suggested very large cost savings just from putting health information technology in. CBO has written about some of the shortcomings in those studies. My view on health information technology, and you will see this in the report that we already put out and the reports that are coming out in December, is that it's necessary but not sufficient for significant improvements in efficiency. It is a key part of an overall system, including involving changes in incentives for providers, but by itself, it is not sufficient to work wonders. Furthermore, if we were serious about spurring the adoption of health information technology, we would not be employing the current policy approach of providing very small subsidies for the adoption of health information technology, which will only induce those providers that are very close to adopting voluntarily to do so. Instead, Alan already mentioned you could provide incentives under the payment system. I will raise the question of if we were really serious about broader health IT, why we don't go the route that we did in the e-prescribing legislation that was just enacted, which is to provide, if you want, a small transition subsidy, but basically say to providers, you have 3 or 4 years or 5 years or whatever you want it to be to adopt a health IT system that meets the following standards or has the following characteristics, and if after that time you don't, you will no longer be reimbursed under Medicare and Medicaid. I guarantee you we would have nearly universal HIT in this country if we did that, and if we were really serious about getting HIT, even though that's politically unpopular, that is probably what we do. By the way, I mentioned that at a finance committee hearing a few weeks ago. Someone, it was Senator Roberts of Kansas, asked me what we could do to really get health IT adopted immediately. I gave that answer, and he audibly groaned. Senator Rockefeller then turned to me and said, you know, Peter, I like you. You always speak the truth. Senator Roberts got up in the middle of the hearing and passed me a note and said, I like you too, which I still don't really understand. But... in any case, let me turn to the second main point that I wanted to make, which is going to take us through a small detour in economics. But since Stanford prides itself on moving across different fields and collaborations across different fields, I hope that's appropriate. In economics, there has been a dramatic growth in what's called behavioral economics over the past 10 to 15 years. And what behavioral economics is all about is moving beyond the simple Econ 101, rational, optimizing, we're all walking around with a supercomputer in our heads approach, and taking psychology and social norms and defaults and other things like that into account. And where I'm going to go with this is I think that movement in economics has been hugely beneficial, and that we need to encourage the same movement in health policy and in medical science. So first, about the power in economics, I think the most compelling example of this phenomenon comes from retirement saving, where according to the rational model that if you suffered through Econ 101 you were taught, all that should matter is your projected income and the match rate that a company offers and the tax structure for retirement contributions. And it shouldn't matter whether you have to check a box to be in a 401k plan or check a box to be out of the 401k plan, because you're hyper-rational and checking the box is an easy thing to do either way. It turns out in practice that if you're automatically enrolled in the 401k plan, participation rates are much higher with the ability to opt out than if you have to affirmatively sign up, which is what this graph shows. This graph is an affront to traditional Econ 101 thinking. And the important point here is, look at low-income workers. You go from participation rates of about a quarter to about three quarters. There's not a match rate in the world. There's not a Econ 101 incentive in the world that can get you the same kick to participation. In other words, the default matters a lot more than the financial incentive, even though both matter. So now let's turn to first medical science. Is medical science suffering from the same kind of limitation that economics has long suffered from? And I would put to you that the placebo effect may be the best and most compelling example of the same problem, which is to say the placebo effect seems to be dismissed as a statistical annoyance rather than examined in and of itself, even though in many settings it is more powerful than the intervention that is being examined. So, for example, in antidepressants, the placebo effect appears in a recent meta-analysis to be twice as influential as the drug impact itself. You have very amazing results from, I love this experiment. So in this experiment, they took people who clean hospital rooms, and they randomly separated them into two groups. And they told one group of hotel cleaners that what they do every day qualifies as physical exercise. They didn't tell the other group anything. They didn't monitor. No one worked any harder, exercised more outside of work. Simply telling people that what they do every day is physical exercise generates results that are similar to actual exercise. So these are the dark blue lines. Their weight drops, their percentage body fat drops, their systolic blood pressure drops. I didn't show you the triglycerides drop. I now walk around CBO saying, sitting in front of a computer qualifies as physical exercise. And I want to see what the results are. Again, I think we are ignoring the role of psychology and beliefs to our detriment in medical science. This kind of thing seems very surprising. And the question then becomes, are there systematic aspects of this belief system or the placebo effect that can be examined? So this is another great experiment that this time a bunch of economists did, in which they administered placebo pills to people who were receiving shocks of different intensity. As you move to the right on this graph, the shock intensity is higher. As you move up on the vertical axis, the pain relief from the placebo is larger. So I think what the key point here is, if you give someone a placebo pill and you say it costs $2.50 a pill, it generates a very large reduction in pain intensity. If you tell them it costs 10 cents a pill, it doesn't seem to work very well. So a perceived expensive placebo pill is much more effective than a cheap placebo pill. And I think that just informs the view that beliefs are very important and that there are systematic things that we can start examining about the operation of the placebo effect itself. Well, that's for the sort of pure medical science. What about the practice of healthcare and the delivery of healthcare? And again, I think we have compelling examples of interventions that sort of purely rational thinking would suggest don't really make a lot of sense, but that in practice matter a lot. So, for example, one major problem that occurs, those of you who are more familiar with hospitals will know this quite well, is infections from insertions of catheters in intensive care units, which can lead to significant costs and even to death. A group in Michigan put in a simple five-step checklist to reduce the infections from catheters, that first you have to do this sterilization, then you have to do this, and what have you, and achieved a very substantial 75% reduction in infection rates from the catheterization process. It appears that the reason that occurred was nothing more than enabling and empowering the nurses to say to a doctor, you skip step three, because the checklist existed, whereas when it was less formal or less formalized, they didn't feel like they had the internal power to do that. And what's interesting about that is, for some reason, in this ICU setting, it worked. It changed the social interaction between nurses and doctors. But when they tried to export it to other settings, it did not work. There was something about the interaction between nurses and doctors in other settings that made this not exportable. And I would just put to you that I think we need to be examining in much more detail why this sort of thing works in some settings and not in others, and that we may get a larger return on our investment dollars from those kinds of questions than from things that may seem like more traditional aspects of healthcare policy. And let me end this part with all of us as consumers and human beings ourselves, and speak just for a second about both diet and exercise, but I'll focus on diet. Because again, I think, basically to a first approximation, what we eat has less to do with how hungry we are than with the way food is presented to us and the context in which it is presented to us. And I'll just run you through a quick example that's one of my favorite making that point. It's perhaps not surprising that people who are given stale popcorn eat less of it than people who are given fresh popcorn. That's this chart. It may not be surprising that people who are given a larger bucket of fresh popcorn eat more of it than people who are given a smaller bucket of fresh popcorn. But what I find really surprising is that if you put people in front of a movie, a group like this, you put them in front of a movie, you age popcorn, which is to say you make it stale, totally disgusting popcorn, you give people different sized buckets of popcorn, the people who are given larger buckets of stale popcorn eat more of it than the people who are given smaller buckets of stale popcorn, which makes really no sense when you think about it, other than that we're mindlessly consuming food in a particular context. Now, this may seem kind of off the beaten track, but 20% of Americans participate in some form of a federal nutrition program, whether it's food stamps, which has been renamed SNAP for Supplemental Nutrition Assistance Program in recent legislation, or the school lunch program. And there do appear to be opportunities to take lessons from how people actually interact with their food and apply them in the food stamp program and the school lunch program that we have not really explored. And I will close on this thought. One of the biggest impacts from behavioral economics in retirement saving is to level the participation rate gradient by income. So what you really do is you basically, in a traditional plan, you have much lower participation rates for low-income people than high-income people, and you put in automatic enrollment, you kick up the bottom and kind of level the playing field. We are facing a very significant change that I think is underappreciated in mortality rates by income. Many people know that life expectancy is going up. Lots of people have heard about income inequality. Very few people have recognized that life expectancy inequality is rising markedly. So what this chart shows you is the increase in average life expectancy and the increase in the gap in life expectancy between the top and the bottom of the income distribution, or the socioeconomic status distribution, between 1980 and 2000. And what you can see is that the increase in the gap is almost as large as the increase in the average life expectancy. And what I would suggest to you is that this is occurring for a variety of reasons, the least important of which is probably access to the healthcare system, the most important of which is probably health behaviors themselves, like diet and exercise, and that it may well be that if we paid a lot more attention to defaults and social norms and the sort of psychological aspect of both public policies and corporate policies and what have you, the primary impact would be to help mitigate this differential, at least to some degree, just like it is with automatic enrollment in 401ks. And I would put forward to you that I think this phenomenon, regardless of whether those behavioral interventions are or are not going to pan out, is something that you will need to be paying much more attention to, not just because of its social consequences, but also because this has very important implications for our federal programs, which consume most of my day. For example, in Social Security, the fact that life expectancy inequality is rising so much means that the program is increasingly less progressive on a lifetime basis. In Medicare and Medicaid, there will also be important implications. So just like economics has learned more from Psychology 101, I would hope that medical science and healthcare policy would also. And just to, again, return to those of you who fell asleep during most of the talk, healthcare costs are rising, big inefficiencies, and then we can do a lot more, I think, to incorporate fresh thinking about how people actually behave into health policy itself. I have a couple minutes for questions, and I thank you very much. Right down here. I think they're going to bring you a microphone.
Thank you for that, Peter. And looking at the intra-country, Peter Farrell, by the way, and looking at the intra-country statistics and best practices, Mayo versus UCLA in that case you used, knowing is not enough, we must apply. And therefore, just letting UCLA know about Mayo isn't going to really
right.
move the needle. And presumably you've thought about how you use these statistics. And it seems to me the only way to really get traction is with some cost incentive. And how are you going to do that? And then with all the special interests that are flowing around Congress, the Senate, and so forth, how do you move the dial?
Information by itself may have some effect, but you're absolutely right that unless you change financial incentives, it doesn't have much kick. To a first approximation in healthcare, I think we get what we provide financial incentives for providers to provide. Right now, we have financial incentives for more care rather than better care, and guess what we get? More care. So to change that, we do need to change the financial incentives. All of the debate is about how to do that, whether it's accountable homes, whether it's pay for performance. How exactly do you change the financial incentives? And I would just caution that while that absolutely has to happen. Before we know how to realign incentives to produce better care, it would be helpful to know more precisely what better care is. And that brings me back to, we conduct way too much of the medical care delivered in the United States is not backed by specific evidence that it works better than something else. And we do need to address that, and then we need to back that up with financial incentives. And the only other thing I would say is, having now walked around showing that UCLA slide, in speech after speech after speech, I have decided that if I get sick in the city of Los Angeles, that is not where I am going personally, because I'm worried about retribution. Right here. Well, one of the reasons that this, the question is, what about obesity? Obesity has been increasing, especially at the very upper end of the body mass index distribution. There's been disproportionate growth there among basically the very obese. And we have been it's not just the incidence of obesity, but in a sense, the intensity of treating obesity or the costs associated with it that have been rising significantly. Which, by the way, that latter factor is actually a more important force in why the share of spending attributable to obese beneficiaries has been rising, that we're treating them more intensely. The question is what to do about it. And I would also, by the way, note, as I was trying to highlight, it has a very significant socioeconomic gradient to it, although obesity rates are rising even among high-income, better-educated people. It's very difficult to know precisely what to do. I do think the behavioral things that I'm focusing on are going to be more effective than, there are proposals from the traditional economics perspective for, the Twinkie tax kind of approach where you try to impose a tax on high-calorie, low-nutrient food. And actually, the UK has a version of this, although I was amused that apparently, if I remember right, potato chips but not pretzels or something like that, potato chips count for the special tax in the UK, but others don't. And there was a debate about Pringles and whether they qualified as potato chips or this other form, and therefore whether they were taxed or not. The point just being that traditional approach probably is unlikely to be particularly effective, and we need to be thinking about the diet and exercise impediments. I would not be surprised. I'm not aware of evidence on this, but just, for example, on exercise, I would not be surprised if small impediments to exercise generate disproportionate reductions in exercise, just like small impediments to retirement saving generate disproportionate participation. So, you know, for example, having to walk 2 or 3 blocks to the gym, which might seem like a small impediment, could have a very large effect relative to having a gym, you know, right down the hallway kind of thing. I don't know that for sure, but I think those things, and then again, how food is presented and displayed will have a marked effect, as will social norms, which are difficult to influence. I don't have the answers, but it's obviously a very significant concern, and one that I don't think anyone at this point really has the set of tools that would dramatically alter the course that we're on. Over here.
You mentioned the use of the placebo, and in clinical medicine, it's considered largely unethical, immoral, and to be avoided. In fact, the gold standard for research is to do a double-blind experiment in which nobody believes in what's going on. How would you propose to put the placebo back into clinical medicine?
Well, I think there are ethical questions, and I am not advocating that we literally trick everyone into good health. But my point just being that I think what it underscores is the importance of belief and some of the old style medicine, the bedside manner and what have you. Herbert Benson, who runs the Mind-Body Institute at Harvard Medical, I think has written is among the people who have written the most about the various ways in which this could be influenced. The head of the American Cancer Society says it's not the disease a person gets, but rather the person who gets the disease. And that, I think, is very consistent with the power of the placebo effect. So it's not that we should go out and start marketing placebo pills as the cure-all to any healthcare problem. Although I did read an article that apparently some parental group is now marketing a placebo pill that you can give to your kids when they complain about a headache or a backache or something. You don't want to actually give them medicine. There's some little pill you can buy. I'm not advocating that. But I am advocating that we need to pay way more attention to how to create and induce positive beliefs about recovery and health, because it seems to matter a lot in terms of the effectiveness of what we get.
Don Prolo, and I'm a neurosurgeon. Dr. Orszag, I have two questions. One relates to your comment to the two senators. And would you not
this will be the last question, since I've run over. Yeah, sorry.
Would you not be fearful that the effect of requiring HIT in offices would result in fewer participating physicians in Medicare as an alternative to all of them jumping to the opportunity to collect, which is really at times below input costs to provide care to the Medicare patient? And the second question relates to HIT and data mining. What's really major in the minds of physicians, many physicians, is the prospect of insurance companies and the government and employers mining data that could be used against a patient, particularly by those entities that are not controlled by HIPAA, Google, or whatever.
So let me deal with that second question first. I think there are a couple layers to that. One is obvious privacy concerns, which have surfaced throughout the debate on HIT. But even if the data are stripped of any individual identifiers, I think there are questions about the degree to which either the government or a quasi-governmental entity or private insurance firms use the data to intervene in a sort of statistical discrimination kind of way, even without individual identifiers. All I would say is, while that is a risk, and I am not a moral philosopher that's qualified to evaluate the trade-offs that are involved, I would say that we have little choice other than to be, if we want to capture these efficiencies or try to mitigate the inefficiencies, other than to use data more intensely in this sector. I'll just come back to it is remarkable to me that even in my own, with regard to my own health care, which luckily thus far is not that complicated, I am presented with questions that I can't get empirical answers to and that I would want some data on. So while there's some risk to individuals from this, there's also a potential benefit. From a system-wide perspective, I don't really see an alternative, and the risks just need to be managed in a way that tries to minimize them. Now, with regard to participation itself, again, one could offer small subsidies up front for some period of time. I believe that the underlying issue with regard to physician participation in particular, since you mentioned physicians, with regard to Medicare, is more about what will happen to the sustainable growth rate formula and not as much about an HIT requirement, which is to say, if the sustainable growth rate formula were reformed in some way that made participation sustainable in the Medicare program, an HIT requirement is unlikely to induce vast majorities of physicians not to participate. And similarly, if the sustainable growth rate formula were not modified in a way that will make it more attractive over time for physicians to participate, the absence or presence of the HIT of an HIT requirement is not going to be of first order importance either. Thank you very much.
We'll be mulling for a long time. Peter is around for some of the afternoon, I think, so you can pigeonhole him in the corridor during a break to talk more. Please join me in welcoming and thanking Peter Orszag for his terrific contribution. Don't leave those seats. We're going to move right into our first panel discussion to really start to dig a little deeper into aspects of innovation that are of high interest to this group. Let me ask the panelists just to come on, and then I'm going to do brief introductions once they're seated. Welcome all. Do we have our third panelist? Is he being mic'd or he's coming up? Okay. Well, the topic of this panel now is innovation in healthcare in the United States, obviously at the heart of what we're talking about today. And we've got terrific thought leaders and representatives from three critical angles of vision, really, into this question, from the question of healthcare delivery itself, from the question of the payment system and all the complexity and potential that we know that system actually holds, as well as technology and new technological development and the business side of that, which is going to be critical to making progress in all the terrains that we want to. In terms of our ground rules, what I'll do is in a moment just briefly introduce our distinguished panelists, ask each of them to offer 7 or 8 minutes of opening remarks from their perspective on this set of questions, and there's a handy little digital timer that they'll find to their left up here to help keep them in a friendly way on track with the time. Then I will tease out some discussion based on what we've heard in their opening thoughts, and we'll leave plenty of time for Q&A with this audience. So without further ado, let me just briefly let you know who our panelists are. George Halverson, immediately on your left, is the chairman and CEO of Kaiser Foundation Health Plan and Kaiser Foundation Hospitals, headquartered in Oakland. He has more than 30 years of healthcare management experience, formerly president and CEO of Health Partners, headquartered in Minneapolis. He's also the author of several widely acclaimed books on the healthcare system, including most recently, Healthcare Reform Now, which is getting lots of discussion among policymakers and opinion leaders in healthcare across the globe. So a special welcome to you, George Halverson. Gail Walensky, next to George, is an economist and a senior fellow at Project HOPE, which is an international health education foundation where she's a leading analyst and policy developer on healthcare reform and ongoing changes in the environment. Her roster of activities is impressive and too much to go into now. Suffice it to say that I first encountered Gail and became incredibly impressed with her thinking on this stuff, I think back when she was running HCVA, for those of us who have been in these debates long enough to remember what HCVA was, which is now CMS, and she was deeply involved in the Bush administration, the first Bush administration policymaking as well. So welcome to you, Gail. And then finally on the panel is Brooke Byers, another person who needs little introduction. Brooke's been a venture capital investor since the early 1970s. He's been closely involved with more than 50 new technology-based ventures, over half of which have become public companies, and he's been doing deep investments in life sciences now as part of KPCB for a very long time. So welcome to you, Brooke. And let us begin then in terms of opening remarks with George Halverson.
Good afternoon. How you doing? I'm going to make a few relatively brief remarks so we can get to the question and answer time as quickly as possible. This is an illustrious audience, and I would expect some very fun and entertaining and hopefully illuminating questions. A couple comments first. One is that we need to focus the attention of healthcare reform in this country on the actual cost of care and on the delivery of care. We spend roughly $2.3 trillion in healthcare in America today, and we spend that money in a non-system of care that is disorganized, siloed, inconsistent, sometimes unsafe, and very perversely incented. We buy care by the piece and not by the package. We don't have data to track care performance, and we don't have systems or processes to link caregivers with each other. 75% of our care dollars are spent on patients with chronic conditions, and 80% of those dollars are spent on patients with comorbidities. When patients in America have more than one health condition, they have more than one doctor. Those doctors typically are not linked or coordinated with each other in any way. They keep separate medical records, and they keep them in separate paper filing systems. Those pieces of paper are not connected or linked or interactive in any way. Patients work with a paucity of data. Patients make uninformed choices about their own care all of the time. Care, as you've heard, is extremely inconsistent, and it is extremely non-systematic. The RAND study showed that barely 50% of the patients with major healthcare conditions received appropriate levels of care for their conditions. That's 50% of the patients in this country. For diabetic patients, the percent who receive all right care was less than 10%. Now, diabetes is the fastest growing disease in America. It's the number one cause of blindness, the number one cause of amputations, the number one cause of kidney failure. About 32% of all of the costs of Medicare are spent on diabetics, and diabetics in this country got the entire care package that they should have received less than 10% of the time. So the non-system of care in this country is massively flawed, and we need better care. We need systematic, data-rich, patient-focused care. We need caregivers who are connected with each other for the care of individual patients. We need to recognize the fact that chronic care expends 75% of the healthcare dollars, and chronic care is a team sport. We need to play it in teams with mechanisms and tools that support the functioning of each team. We need electronic medical records so that we have electronic access to care, not paper medical records. We need care tracking, not isolated care silos. We have a long way to go, and there is a lot of low-hanging fruit in the healthcare delivery system of this country. We have massive opportunities to improve the efficiency and the cost of care by improving the quality and the consistency of care. Kaiser Permanente, we have invested slightly more than $4 billion rolling out electronic medical records and care support tools. And one of the things we learned in that process is that the electronic medical record all by itself is, as you heard earlier, necessary but insufficient. The electronic medical record gives doctors data about patients in a more consistent way and in real time, and that's extremely important. But what an EMR by itself doesn't do is explain what each patient should have next. It doesn't plan care for patients. You need to support the EMR with the next generation of electronic care support tools. Care registries that focus on the patients and identify for each patient what treatments they should have, what tests they should have, what follow-up they should have, and then tracks the patients relative to the care that they are receiving is the necessary next step that turns the EMR into a true care improvement tool. If you just put an EMR in place, stand back and wait for care to get better, it actually will get a little bit better, but it will not get a lot better. But if you focus on patients with comorbidities and identify exactly what care they need and then make sure that the caregivers involved work with each other, coordinate with each other, make sure the patient gets the care, then you see significant transformations in care. So we've been doing a number of pilots at Kaiser Permanente. Now that we have the database, we're doing pilots to figure out how to use the database. Northern California, we've cut the number of heart attacks by about 40% by following up consistently with patients at risk of that condition. In Hawaii, multi-island pilot, we cut the number of kidney failures by over 40%. Again, with just consistent follow-up care. No new science, old science, consistently delivered. Colorado, we took every single heart patient, ran them through the electronic medical record, and then ran them through a care registry identifying best practices, followed up to make sure the prescriptions were filled and the tests were done, and all of the follow-up happened. And in Colorado, we ended up with a 73% reduction in the death rate from the two major forms of heart disease just by delivering care consistently using the care support tools available to us. So we know from the pilots that this approach works. We know it's the right thing to do. We know that going forward, medical science needs that kind of data and needs that kind of support tool. We believe that doctors need to be supported by real-time, comprehensive patient information that's supported by current medical data. For the entire country, we believe that there should be a focus on chronic patients. We do such a bad job, we do such a horrible job as a country in taking care of patients with chronic conditions that we should have a national focus on those patients. And then for those patients, and particularly for the ones with comorbidities, we should put in place care coordination tools that turn chronic care into a team sport for those caregivers. And the data sharing is different for each patient. There's not just one formula for patients. Patients with comorbidities have different mixes of needs. You need care support tools that link the caregivers on a very patient-specific basis. And the final point that I would make is that we need, as a country, to become a culture of continuous learning in healthcare. Healthcare in this country is not in a continuous learning mode. It's in a sporadic, siloed, inconsistent, piecemeal learning mode. And what we need is a philosophy that we are going to learn collectively, that we're going to share the information, that we're going to have a database that lets us track care and build best practices based on the care and deliver the right care to the patients, but continuously improve. The Institute of Medicine right now has a task force on evidence-based medicine, and the goal of that institute is to have 90% of care in this country delivered based on medical science by the year 2020. Now think about how that's a decade away to get to 90% of the care based on science. We should feel horrible that that's the goal that's set. And the Institute spent a lot of time debating whether or not that goal was too ambitious. So I'll close by saying that if we delivered care appropriately to all of our patients, and if we did turn chronic care into a team sport, and if we did give caregivers the tools to link the care, we should be able to cut kidney failures in this country by 50%. We should be able to cut congestive heart failure crises by 50 to 90%. We should be able to cut the asthma crises, require hospitalizations, 50 to 90%. We could make a significant difference in the quality of care, the outcomes of care, and the cost of care. And the missing factor is the toolkit necessary to support the caregivers in that process. So as a matter of public policy, we should be focusing on chronic care, and as a matter of public policy, we should be focusing on taking those tools that exist now and putting them in place for all relevant patients. So that's my suggestion, and I look forward to the question and answer.
Thank you very much. Thank you, George, and we'll hear now from Gail Walensky.
I have enough trouble saying over the podium. I don't need this up my way. It's a pleasure to be with you today. I was one of those Washington people that was coming in to muddy up your nice, clean area, but I won't talk much Washington talk, or at least not as it relates to politics. other than to say right now, as we struggle with regard to how to try to expand coverage, there are some areas that relate in a much more consistent way as you look across proposals about what we can do to try to improve the delivery of healthcare in our system today. Peter Orszag showed very clearly the unsustainability of our current rate of healthcare spending growth. Not only is that the case, which many of you have seen before, but it is going on at the same time that we see many problems with regard to quality and clinical appropriateness. He showed you slides that indicated there is a lack of relationship between how much we spend and the quality of healthcare is provided, that's provided in those areas. And it's the coming together of those pieces of information that has led many of us to think that we can begin to change the delivery system if we can adopt other strategies based on better information and based on better incentives. And I just want to talk a few minutes this afternoon about how I see the use of better information and better incentives as a way to help us learn smarter, to practice smarter, and learn how to spend smarter. But importantly for this group, I think it is also possible to have this happen in a way that will not delay time to market for new products and new innovations. And I want to save a couple minutes at the end to indicate how I think this is possible to go forward. Not only important when you are near to Silicon Valley, but very important to an aging American population who is very much interested in having innovative products and services be available to them as they age. One of the problems that we face in this country, in addition to the issues that that George has laid out with regard to health IT and better clinical support decisions for the clinician, is to realize that we do not have enough information on basic comparative clinical information. That is, what works best for whom, under what circumstances. There is some work that has been done to try to get better learning from the data that already exists. IOM study that was released early this year, indicating more problems than many of us realized with regard to the systematic reviews of information that have been done in the past. But more importantly, it's the recognition that we have not made investments in getting better information, particularly as it relates to medical procedures, so that we are in a better position, either as clinicians or as patients or as payers, to have a better understanding about whether a patient with a particular set of symptoms or comorbidities actually will be likely to benefit from the use of a device or a therapeutic or a medical procedure. Other countries have thought about comparative effectiveness primarily as it relates to pharmaceuticals and secondarily to devices, but very few have thought about this as being equally important. Actually, for me as an economist, more important when you talk about medical procedures. More important for actually a very simple reason. That's where the money is. And if we are going to learn how to spend smarter, it will be having better information about what is likely to work best for various types of patients, defined today perhaps in terms of some of their socioeconomic characteristics, but at a later point in terms of their metabolic type or their genotype, or other genetic markers in terms of what is likely to impact them. There's a lot of interest right now in trying to set up an entity that would focus on that. Baucus and Conrad, Democrat leadership in the Senate, introduced a bill in July that would move down this way. It is one of these areas that appears to attract some interest on both sides of the aisle and in both houses. Peter Orszag's group at CBO has done some estimating that even without bringing in financial incentives, how better information could begin to have a favorable financial impact. But, of course, it's important to understand that if we were to also tie better information, two, better use of financial incentives. That would be even more helpful. If we are going to go forward learning how to spend smarter, we need to begin to realign financial incentives between patients and clinicians and institutions. We need to reward patients who engage in healthy lifestyles and some of the ways that Peter had mentioned. We need to set reimbursement rates so that we're reflecting some of the comparative clinical effectiveness information along, of course, with cost data. You certainly can say, why should you pay more if something doesn't do more? But ultimately, we will need to consider how much more does it do, and do we have some sense about how does it fare with regard to the costs of alternative strategies that are available. There was a question earlier about physician reimbursement and a problem in Medicare that many of you know exists today because fees have been kept basically flat the whole decade. At the same time, Part B spending has been increasing 10-12% per year, a frustration to both payers and certainly to physicians because those who are doing well are those who are taking advantage of the ability to have a different mix and volume of services. And those clinicians that are providing care in a conservative manner are being faced with fees that are not rising and not covering the costs of the services that are that they are providing. It is an untenable situation going forward. I have some thoughts I'd be glad to share. There was an interesting hearing last week in the House Ways and Means Committee about reforming physician payment that I participated in. But I wanted to spend at least a minute, because of the interest in innovation for many of you, to talk that if you begin to think about using comparative clinical effectiveness information to set reimbursement rates, it need not delay the time that it takes a product to get to market. If you assume this is information primarily used for reimbursement and that the FDA requirements would continue to be those for coverage, there will be a period between FDA approval and the time that more information is available with regard to comparative clinical effectiveness information. And one of the possibilities is either to have companies go at risk during that period if they are seeking higher reimbursement, or if it is decided that that is too difficult or too harsh a position, to have a clear understanding that at the end of a 2 or 3 year period when more information is available, there would be a secondary decision made going forward as to whether or not the comparative clinical effectiveness information actually supported the claims that were being made. So either the notion of having companies that can withstand the at-risk concept or possibly for smaller biotech companies to allow them not to have to go to risk but to have a second decision-making point 2 to 3 years out in the future is a strategy that would allow us as a country to make better use of information without delaying the time it gets to market. Not the only strategy, but simply the point that we can find strategies that both will help us learn how to spend smarter without putting ourselves in a position where we are deterring desired and interesting innovations in healthcare. Thank you.
Thanks very much, Gail. And we'll hear finally from Brooke Byers.
Thank you, and thank you, Alan, for inviting me to come today to celebrate the 10th anniversary of the center here at Stanford. So today I represent innovators on the product side from the private sector and progress from the front lines. Genes matter. Patients with cancer, heart disease, rheumatoid arthritis, osteoporosis, and other diseases have individual genetic signatures of their manifestation that now today, because of tools from the Human Genome Project and automated instrumentation, can help determine the best therapy. So a quiet revolution is happening in diagnostics, and today my goal is to make it a little less quiet. We've traditionally thought of diagnostics as the front-end part of healthcare, relatively inexpensive, that informs the practitioner, doctor, and the patient on infection, serum levels, things like that. But now, thanks to these breakthroughs that I was talking about of gene signatures, a stream of molecular diagnostics products, or laboratory-developed tests, LDTs, are coming available not only to detect the disease, but to help manage optimally that disease, the individual phenotype of that disease, over time. They will provide evidence-based guidelines and information linking the individual genetic variations of that person's disease to medication response profiles. This is the true personalized medicine. So these new molecular diagnostic tests are coming available. They will be priced higher than the way we've traditionally thought of diagnostics, those simple tests that have been ordered from the path lab. Why? Because they involve multiple gene expression patterns or complex protein patterns that need to be measured in very complex CLIA lab environments using instrumentation. It takes about 3 years to develop these kinds of tests and tens of millions of dollars not only to develop them but to do statistically valid clinical validation trials on them and to publish those in peer-reviewed journals. These costs need to be recovered. So should tests that will cost $750 to $5,000 be feared by people who want to get a grip on healthcare expenditures, by the medical profession, payers, FDA, and policymakers, or should they be embraced? They should be embraced because they can show excellent healthcare economics. Furthermore, there are best ways, therefore, of saving money in the system. And not only from drugs, but from procedure utilization. Let me give you two examples. First, Oncotype DX is a molecular diagnostic test available today from a company called Genomic Health located in Redwood City near here. It's available to breast cancer doctors and their patients. It tests a tumor biopsy sample for 21 genes and analyzes those gene expression patterns using real-time PCR. It's done in a certified CLIA lab. And it predicts the chance of recurrence of that individual's breast cancer tumor type for that specific person. It also predicts the specific biology of that tumor and whether or not it will respond to chemotherapy. Currently, 90% of women with estrogen receptor positive, node negative breast cancer get chemotherapy. But it's now been shown that less than 10% will show a survival benefit from that chemo. Does this make sense? Absolutely not. But it wasn't until recently that a test was available to determine chance of recurrence and response to chemo. And they don't get that benefit either because they were not going to recur anyway or because the specific biology of their tumor was not going to respond to chemo. Now, this newer test has been out 3 years. It's going to be used 40,000 times this year. It's already changing 25% of treatment decisions by breast cancer doctors and their patients. And that change should probably go to 50% in a few years. So it changes the experience for the patients who forego chemo, and we all know about the toxicity and hospitalizations of that. But since this conference is about healthcare costs, let me focus on that part. It saves the healthcare payers and system money. At $30,000 on average per chemo regimen, all-in costs, therefore this year of the 40,000 patients who will have this test run on their tumor sample, 10,000 will forego chemotherapy. That's a saving to the system of $300 million. The test is priced at $3,400. So imagine the response of payers when they hear that price. They think of tests and a lot of their computer algorithms at payer organizations is if it's below $400, just reimburse it. $3,400 causes a lot of pausing. Mostly it went to a 999 category or one that's automatically kicked for review. But think about it. If chemo costs on average $30,000 and one quarter less chemo is used, then the economic value of that test is $7,500. It only costs $3,400. This is value. And although the test is now recommended in ASCO guidelines, it is still not 100% covered by payers. Medicare is the best payer in terms of having adopted and covering this because it thinks about the long-term value of its beneficiaries. Medicare actually thinks about the long-term total system costs of its payers, and Bruce Quinn, at one of the contractors, saw this. But private payers have been slow rolling this, either by really high copays or putting a lot of hassle on the practitioner, the breast cancer specialist, as what it takes to be able to order this test. My second example, AlloMap is a genomic molecular test available to transplant surgeons and patients. It tests a transplant patient's blood sample for a gene expression pattern of 20 genes in real-time PCR in a CLIA lab in a company called XDX, located up in South San Francisco. This test determines whether a transplant patient is rejecting their heart or their lung, transplanted organ. The traditional way of biopsying this to see it, and it's usually done monthly for a heart transplant patient, is to insert a set of scissors, literally, down the jugular vein into the heart and taking a tissue sample. This can now be done by a blood test. And it's very important to titrate the immunosuppression drugs right, because too little can allow rejection, too much can allow cancer and opportunistic infection. At a price of $2,800, this test is roughly half the cost all in of the biopsy procedures. I could go on with other examples. It was mentioned earlier today that the coming wave of biologics, these are incredibly effective drugs for the patients who are responsive to them. But as I hope I pointed out, disease is individualistic. And not only the individualistic host system, but how it's expressed in that individual. So that's why not all drugs work for everyone. On average, drugs only work in 60% of the people who receive them. And it's because of what I've been describing. So don't we need a test or tests that actually determine who would be responder? Think of Erbitux, the antibody biologic now that's used for stage 2 colon cancer, very expensive. Or Avastin. Or even in procedures in prostate cancer. In a recent study, it showed only a 5% absolute decrease in prostate cancer-specific survival, none in overall survival, for radical prostatectomy and radiation therapy, which cause, as we know, significant side effects. Imagine a test who could determine which of the patients are actually biologically at high risk of recurrence. We don't know that yet, so what we do is we treat them all. So who would not be excited about this revolution? Well, various interest groups. One is this is going to cause a share shift from drugs to diagnostics. It won't be wholesale, but it will be a shift from certain kinds of drug market penetration to diagnostics. Secondly, it will require payers, who should be the natural allies of this revolution, to take a fresh look at how they reimburse. Up to this point, an antiquated system called CPT codes has been used, which actually has the perverse effect of the more complex you make the diagnostic, the more the manufacturer will be reimbursed, when in fact diagnostics should be made as simple as possible. But they should be reimbursed on value and demand the manufacturers in the private sector to put forward healthcare economic studies to prove it. Another example is called date of service, an unintended consequence of the Medicare bundling rule. In the date of service rule, it says wherever the specimen is taken, that is who should do the billing. Well, if the patient is in a hospital when the specimen is taken and then goes home, and later that specimen, that tissue biopsy, blood sample or whatever, is sent to an outside lab for these new laboratory developed tests I've talked about. Right now, Medicare wants the hospital to bill. Well, this obviously makes no sense because the hospital's not running the test. They can't vouch for the validity of the test, and they don't want the liability. So this quirk is causing access problems for doctors and patients and should be fixed. The FDA also needs to modernize the way it's looking at diagnostics. These new tests are not in vitro diagnostics and cannot be simply regulated under the in vitro diagnostic rules. Blinded retrospective studies with quality sample banks and medical histories are as scientifically valid as blinded prospective studies. This has been shown recently by the two examples I gave you, which are already being adopted into care, and the AlloMap test for transplantation just received FDA approval. But it was not easy. And finally, the medical provider needs to change their way of thinking about diagnostics. These that I'm talking about are actually full patient management systems. And when integrated with EMRs, electronic medical records, can then provide the whole spectrum of care for the patient. Thank you.
Thanks very much, Brooke. Well, there's obviously a tremendous amount of yeasty stuff that we could discuss, and we won't do full justice to it in the time we have. But within the whole umbrella, which all of you are operating in terms of innovation to boost value, George, let me start with you. In terms of the pilots that you guys have been having, what sounds like such promising results in terms of innovation and care delivery, can you talk a little more about the lessons you're learning from how you actually implement these? Is there resistance from doctors and nurses? Is there a culture shift in medicine that needs to take place? You know, when you talk about getting into a continuous learning environment, not just in your own system or in pockets of it, but then for the country, what are the early lessons from how you're implementing these pilots that you'd share in terms of what the agenda needs to be?
One of the things that we've been doing as a system is working on creating that culture of continuous learning and a culture of continuous improvement, and so we've been sharing with our caregivers the value of having good data, good information, and having consistency to care, and we are celebrating internally the results. So when we have a really great result, if we have heroes, if we have champions, if we celebrate it, if we talk about it, every caregiver I know wants to do a great job. Every doctor that I know wants to do the right thing for every patient. So if there's a sense that if you do this, you'll cut the number of heart attacks in half, and people believe that to be true, then there's a very high likelihood that the support will be there. Initially, there was some skepticism in various places, but at this stage of the game, the electronic medical record is rolled out everywhere. I think if we tried to, at this stage of the game, take it away from the caregivers, there would be a resistance that was significantly higher than the resistance of putting it in.
And, Gail, I want to get you in one sec, but when you think yourself, I understood your point about the Institute of Medicine's goal of 90% evidence-based care by 2020 as being depressingly kind of long-term. How do you think in your own system about more ambitious goals nearer term as you try and roll this out through your own system, and can you share that briefly?
I'm sorry.
This is still with you, George.
I thought it was Gail's question. Ask it briefly again.
Sure. If the 90% goal by 2020 is depressingly long-term,
we need to
do you think internally about, you know, within what you can control within your four walls?
Our four walls, we want to have an immediate feedback cycle. We want the care support systems to have the best science on a regular basis. We have a group called the Care Management Institute whose job is to keep up with current science, to disseminate it, to test it, to share it. And so we want to be on a cycle that's closer to the rest of industry and kind of a 12-month, 24-month cycle of taking what works and getting it out as opposed to a two-decade cycle.
Thanks. Now, Gail Walensky, you talked, as Alan Garber did, about trying to get, you know, again, baking value value choices and value judgments into the payment system. How do you think about the, because you've been in politics also, the political dynamics of trying to move the system in this direction? What do you see as the biggest obstacles, and what are the reasons, at least, that give you hope at this point, if you're hopeful? With Project Hope, right? So.
Yes, I have to be hopeful. Also, I've been working in healthcare a long time. You have to take little wins and go a long way. What I mean, and what Alan has meant, he and I have spoken about this a great deal, is thinking about a value-based insurance system where instead of using tiered copayments to reflect the best buys of a pharmaceutical benefit company, you begin to think about using tiered copayments to reflect those diagnostics or medical procedures that make the most sense clinically for a patient in a particular configuration. You don't say no. You try to allow people, the clinicians and the patients, to make their own decisions, but make it more expensive if the likelihood of a good outcome is very low, or the relative benefit is very small compared to the additional cost that is around. So it is beginning to think of a reimbursement system that encourages the care that seems to make the most sense, given what we know. First thing is, we know pitifully little about many things, because except for testing compared to a placebo, occasionally state-of-the-art, one by one on a drug and device, we don't ask those questions. So the first thing is, we need to be investing, I believe, billions as opposed to millions in knowing more and then making use of it. The question is, if we had that information and we began to use it, would we be able to change behavior? I think Peter was the one that had mentioned that if we try to slow down spending, the clinicians, industry, hospitals that have been used to having increased spending are not going to take it kindly. And the first response we should assume they will make is there's something about the payer, public or private, that is preventing me as your doctor or the hospital you're going to from providing the right care, the best care, even in a system where it looks like we get about 53% of the right care on average, making it slightly better than a crapshoot when we engage in complicated health care. I think the only hope we have of learning how to spend smarter is to be able to have good evidence that says your expensive diagnostic test actually will provide for a subgroup of the population which we can identify important information that brings value for the table. Mm-hmm. But for all of those other people who think they might like it too, we're not going to pay because the clinical likelihood is very small. Will that be enough to stop our voracious appetite? It'll be tough. But without that kind of clear empirical information, we have no chance, no hope.
Do you worry, staying with you, Gail, just for 1 second, about the pace at which this gets rolled out? Because you look at the Peter or Alan charts on expenditures, and, you know, the aggregate stuff is really rising. I mean, if we go sort of 10 years and we're still piloting this or trying to bake it in, do we hit a, is this like climate change where there's an irreversible tipping point? We may as well all, you know, give it all up in 10 years because we're hitting 20% of GDP?
We better start soon. I'm hopeful that the next year there will be a reasonable comparative clinical effectiveness component to whatever comes on the table. The Baucus-Conrad bill had funding $300 to $500 million, underfunded. I talked with some of the people putting it together, but it's not a trivial amount of money. If we wait 10 years to start, it'll be tough. This is going to be one of these activities where some investment needs to start happening right away, because to the extent we need new blinded trials, some of them may be able to be retrospective. Some of them are going to have to be prospective if it's important enough, big enough amount of money. It's getting people in a position who can make that investment to say, yes, it's expensive, but we start doing things without knowing the likely outcome. CT angiography was in the New York Times this summer. Last fall, there was an article on ablation therapy being adopted by cardiologist for atrial fibrillation, you get about three quarters of the way through the article and it's like, oh, well, actually, we don't have very much information about how the patients are doing 3 or 4 years on after ablation therapy, still on Coumadin or warfarin, compared to just being on warfarin. And my immediate reaction as a former Medicare head is, you know, Medicare might want to know that. There are a lot of Medicare patients who have atrial fibrillation, and you can blow through millions without any difficulty at all. So if we start now, begin to adopt this change in the next 3 to 5 years, 4 to 6 years, I think we could have start having some effect.
Brooke, let me bring you into the conversation. It's interesting because I presume in a lot of the new business or new product situations, you get consumer demand that helps, you know, a new firm or a new industry upend the existing incumbents because they're introducing a better mousetrap and there's actual demand for it that helps shake things up. In the situation you're describing, you're facing a huge large change in the public argument or acts of persuasion among payers, among providers to try and get traction. Can you take us through a little bit? How do you all, am I right that that's a sort of different set of challenges in terms of trying to spark innovative industries that have the ability to add value to a whole sector, but where there's a set of existing mindsets and incumbents that sort of need to be shaken up without the normal sort of consumer demand pull that might drive that faster? How do you guys think about that challenge? Are you out peddling to payers and doing, you know, sort of, it's like it's massive re-education for different aspects of the healthcare system?
It is difficult. So innovation in a lot of industries, in the digital web industry, in the green tech, clean tech industry, and in life science medical industry, often takes place not because there's a groundswell of consumers who say, this is what we want. It takes place because there is a convergence in time of an innovation or a scientific breakthrough of the capability of something being done because of where technology has come to be developed. And then it takes a small set of individuals who say, okay, I understand the problem. I see now how to put it all together. I'm going to make the invention. I'm going to develop the product. And I'm going to take it on out there. This is the risk-taking of entrepreneurship. This is what works, and it works in large companies to entrepreneurship, we call it. But on the other side, there has to be a waiting set of users. Now, so going back to my examples, the way we think about innovation in these young companies and the way these entrepreneur scientists do is they start with a doctor and a patient sitting in an examining room, trying to make a very expensive decision about procedure or medical device or drug. And they have most of the time pretty poor information. So then what we do is we analyze that information. What is the information they need? So let's case, in the case of breast cancer, it's, is it going to recur? Is it chemo responsive? Is it Avastin responsive? Should it get Taxotere? All of these questions, they're trying to decide. The information they've had at this point is some anatomical information, tumor size, age, whatever. It's pretty lousy. So then we go from that need, we work backwards then. We work actually backwards to then what is the biology of what they need to know? Then what tools would speak to that biology? Then how do you assemble all those tools? And then who could assemble those tools and who could make them all work in a product development? That's actually how it's done, and knowing that what sets of tools are available. So it is this convergent meeting. Now, what's different about this industry than green tech or digital or web or IT or computers is that you have all these other constituent parties. You have the payers and regulatory as well with FDA. What's discouraging so far for many innovators is how slow the payers are to be the natural ally.
And why do you think that is, to stay on that for a sec? And by the way, then we will go to questions. So formulate your questions, and there will be folks with microphones coming around, because I know we've got folks who want to ask questions of these groups. But it seems like a no-brainer for payers. So what's the conversation sound like, or what's the obstacle?
Well, I'm going to speak to private payers for now, is that I think for two key reasons. One is that their systems are lousy. So they don't really know what it costs for that patient to be sick. And so what they do is they just look at the front-end cost. and they say, oh, that device or that diagnostic or that drug is really expensive, I think we don't like it. But the patient advocate groups maybe rise up and cause a change or whatever. And the second is that they're short-term. It's the churn of people in a healthcare plan. And that's the downside of the kind of system we have in this country. But whereas Kaiser and Medicare actually are the most intelligent consumers of innovative technology, in my experience, because they have this patient for a very long time. So they take the long-term view.
I don't think so. I think it's because Medicare can't use costs in its deliberations. I would like to think it was because Medicare takes a long-term view because they have the patients once they enter for their life. But it's a budgetary decision through the governmental process, which is basically does not allow that explicitly to be taken into account. I think the question as for the private payers is how convincing is the information that within a reasonable period of time, which may be 1 or 2 years, that it actually does provide value. I think if you can provide that kind of information on a credible basis, you won't have the kind of problem in adoption. It's a question of how convincing is the information that you have when you want to go get something covered. That's my experience as in the private payer world.
We don't have a lot of time, so I do want to get to questions. Obviously, we could get into a lot of these things all day. I saw a hand go up over there. If we can get a microphone over to that person who's standing. Tell us who you are, sir, and who you're with.
Ross Jaffe from Versant Ventures. Dr. Walensky, you described comparative effectiveness research. It sounds a lot like a new form of technology assessment of a gating item for new technology getting to the system. And my understanding of comparative effectiveness research, particularly in light of some of the data that was presented today on variations in medical practice, is that the real focus should be on understanding what is driving the variations in existing medical practice, less about the new technology, more about why we're spending more on ICUs in at UCLA than at UCSF. And also the focus, again, is taking what we do know about effective medicine, as Mr. Halverson has talked about, and making sure it's implemented well. So is the real focus comparative effectiveness research on new technology, or is it on medical practice and the things that are driving existing expenditures?
Those are two separate strains of activity that need to occur. Learning how to be able to capture the lower spend and the spending variation spectrum that you saw, particularly since it doesn't seem that the high spending areas are gaining much in terms of health outcomes or patient preferences, is important. Those are capturing, though, savings at a moment in time. What I've been focusing on is how to try to reduce the growth rate in spending over time. And that's more complicated than just going to the low variation sites. I don't want to belittle that. That's very important. But it isn't the biggest problem we face, which is for the last 45 years, the growth in healthcare spending has grown 2.5 percentage points faster than the economy, the excess spend that economists talk about. That has a lot to do with how new technologies are adopted and infused into the use of medical practice. And at the same time, we learn how to capture the low-spending areas that have high effectiveness. We have got to be serious, not the little technology assessment. I'm talking about the big kinds of questions. What do we know about the treatment of cardiovascular disease in terms of conservative medical treatment versus angioplasty, using stents with or without drug-eluting components versus bypass surgery? Going to the 5 or 10 highest DRGs that show a lot of variation and indicating that's where we're spending a lot of money, and there's a lot of dispute about how that should be provided across the country, and beginning to focus in serious investments that we understand what it is we're likely to get or who. Usually it's a question of being able to target better who really will benefit from those procedures.
We've got time for just one last question, I'm sorry to say, because we're under strict orders to stay on time here, but you may be able to catch some of the folks during a break. Sir, tell us who you are, and we'll try and make the question and the answers equally brief.
Hi, Hal Luff, Palo Alto Medical Foundation Research Institute. Actually, a question for all three of you. Let's stay with the breast cancer example. And suppose that a payer could be Medicare, it could be an insurer, were to say, we'll pay a bundled amount. And you, the clinician, get the information, create a demand for those comparative effectiveness studies, and figure out how to best provide care for each of your patients with breast cancer. And there'll be rewards at the end figuring out how well they're doing at the end of, let's say, 2 years. So that we start putting the physician in the role rather than some agency or nasty insurer who doesn't want to pay for things to make those decisions. I wonder how each of you would think about that.
A quick comment on the generic approach. There's a sense right now on the part of a lot of people that if we could just do a lump sum per patient and then somehow let the caregivers manage all the care, would end up with a better outcome. And that model is almost actuarially impossible because patients have comorbidities, they have differences, they have all kinds of different health status. And so the lump sum amount actually does a disservice to the team that exists to take care of the patient. You don't know what the team is. You do a lump sum on a heart patient. About 30% of heart patients are depressed. And so for 30% of those teams, there should be a psychiatrist on the team. But which patient should have a psychiatrist on the team? How do you split out the amount for the psychiatrist? What do you pay them that year? What do you pay them the following year? If the patient isn't depressed the second year, do you not pay them the second year, or do you pay them more because the patient isn't depressed and they succeeded? I mean, the whole team payment thing is very seductive, but the doctors still don't have the data. They still don't have the information. Most of the heart patients, one of the things we're doing is taking a look at outcomes on oncology, and most oncologists don't even have good statistical information on the outcomes of various treatment approaches. So it's just paying the ignorant a lump sum as opposed to applying science to the medicine. What we need to do is we need to figure out what works. We need to have a science base that's based on what's worked, and then we need to make sure each patient gets what works and not try to get some kind of a silver bullet solution based on writing one check per doctor and then having the doctor be Marcus Welby. That model doesn't work.
Any brief?
I think bundled payments for physicians for taking care of either chronic disease, multiple chronic diseases, since they do tend to be comorbid, or high-cost, high-volume procedures makes some sense compared to paying 7,000 discrete services, which is what Medicare now does. Having said that, if you don't have the information, you're still not going to go very far, and you may well have to risk adjust if there are major differences that might happen, which is really the issue that George was raising. And without having the information, you really don't make much progress.
We'll have to leave it there for now. Please join me in thanking our terrific panel.
Well done.
We will now have a 10-minute break and resume promptly at 3:30. I think there are snacks out in the lobby, so enjoy.
That?